everyone. Welcome to Tip at UT, a podcast where we explore trauma-informed pedagogy on the University of Texas campus. I'm Sarah DePichon.
And I'm Steve Lundy.
And today we are going to play an interview with Dr. Michael Ann Quimby, who is an assistant professor of instruction in the Department of Human Development and Family Sciences.
I've always appreciated learning from Michael Ann's use of trauma-informed pedagogy. I really feel like it reflects such a well-thought-out, comprehensive pedagogy that includes a range of different critical and transformative teaching styles. One of the things that I enjoy about listening to Michael Ann talk about teaching is the way that she exposes the quote-unquote conventional wisdom that a lot of us imbibe, but when we're learning to teach in grad school or in our first years out in teaching is not really wisdom at all, it's just convention. And that, you know, one of the things that she says earlier in the interview about how we're taught not to let the students see us sweat, it really gets in the way of some of the vulnerability and discomfort that is necessary for important, crucial, transformative learning experiences.
Yeah, I was an immediate Michael Ann fan when I met her, because you can just feel the passion and enthusiasm that she has for teaching, and it's really special. And something that I think is really amazing about Michael Ann is that she's really not afraid of learning, which is, you know, what you were touching on, Steve. She is someone who understands a teacher to be someone who is a lifelong learner, and I just really respect that about her. So we hope you enjoy.
So Michael Ann, thank you so much for being here with us. I know Steve and I are both really happy to have you here, because you've become such an integral part of our trauma-informed pedagogy community at UT. Would you like to introduce yourself in your own terms?
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor of instruction in Human Development and Family Sciences Department, which is part of SOHI, which is part of the School of Natural Sciences. I teach full-time. I have a PhD in human development and a master's in organizational leadership and ethics, which is really organizational development. And then my first two degrees were in vocal performance. But I came to teaching about 11 years ago and just knew it was my favorite thing that I'd ever done. And I've done a lot of fun things. So I am happy to talk about it.
One of the ways we like to start talking to our guests about trauma-informed pedagogy is just hearing a little bit about where you first encountered it and what the context was that led to you starting to explore trauma-informed pedagogy and what was attractive or engaging or exciting about it.
That's a good question. So I had worked on a Praxis article when I was still teaching at St. Edward's and working on my PhD on transformative learning, which is a learning theory that is meant to apply to adult learners. And I'd given a lot of thought to the idea of a psychological container and how that works in the classroom, because things like group therapy are based on the idea of a healthy psychological container, but you can't do the same type of container in a classroom as you do in a therapy session. And then how you create a container for learning that allows people to sort of be themselves and express themselves freely even depends a lot on the discipline that you're in and the age of people you're working with. So I'd given that a lot of thought. And then I had a summer class, and my TA assigned to me was Christine Willem, who we know from our community. And she introduced me to the idea of trauma-informed pedagogy. And I felt like there's just so much crossover with the ideas of critical pedagogy and intersectionality and transformative learning and trauma-informed pedagogy are all sort of things that underpin my teaching. And I feel like trauma-informed pedagogy gave me some more guidelines and support for my intuitive way of connecting with students, which is to try and create, through example, an open environment where people are free but not compelled to share on a deeper level and are encouraged to really reflect on the impact of the things that we're studying on their own lives, on their psyches, on their emotions in the moment. So a more self-aware approach to learning, which is kind of the underpinnings of transformative learning and how I came to teaching. When I went from St. Edward's, where I was teaching adult undergraduate learners who were finishing their undergraduate degrees, to UT, where I was teaching a lot of pre-med undergraduates who are traditional age, had to do a sort of a major mental transition in how I connect with students and what type of power distance is appropriate. And so trauma-informed pedagogy sort of really helped me redefine that with my current student population.
That's really, I'm really interested in your use of that term container and your description of the kind of space that you're going for in your classroom. And I'm interested in what your, I guess, feelings are towards the concept of safe and safe space in relation to trauma-informed classrooms.
Okay, so I have thoughts. So my graduate program was non-traditional and very based in critical pedagogy. And there was a lot of discussion of areas being safe spaces when they really weren't, when there weren't really any defined rules or boundaries for what made it safe. We were just, as students, supposed to accept that it was safe. And then if teachers violated our boundaries emotionally or otherwise, we weren't supposed to show that. So the problem with the safe space is twofold. One is that you can't tell someone else it's a safe space, only they can decide whether or not it's safe for them. And it's also just like very much individual to the environment and the self-awareness of the people who are in it. So what I try and create, when I think of a healthy psychological container, I think of an environment where it's okay to tell me I screwed up, right? So it's okay for students to call me out and challenge me on things that I've said that they disagree with. It's okay for them to let me know if something that we're discussing in class is triggering, and we can have dialogue around it, whether it's public or private. The other side of the safe space is I teach in CNS, which is mostly, quote, hard science. And the underlying culture in CNS, particularly for pre-med students, is extremely competitive. At least the anecdotal accounts I've heard from my students, not super supportive. So a lot of the really difficult first and second year classes are referred to as weed out classes by the professors themselves. And so the culture in CNS does not lend itself to saying this is a safe space, because then that sounds like it's unrealistic and soft and mushy and not hard and not clinical and not rigorous, not evidence-based, right? So I stay away from the term because I think that it's almost impossible for it to not be hypocritical. So for me, it's more about like understanding that the example that I set and the rules that I put forward create the beginnings of a culture in the class, and the more I can exemplify the kind of culture that I want, the more it's replicated. And then when I have students who've taken classes with me before and like that environment, they also help replicate those norms for new students. And so norming into the environment that I create becomes easier the longer I've been at UT, because I have more students who've taken my classes before and communicated what they liked about those classes to my other students. But yeah, as for the safe space, I try and avoid that because safety is totally subjective. I don't avoid that term because it's taboo. I avoid it because I don't think you can claim that about an environment. I try and set it up in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I love this idea of norm setting. Is that something that happens explicitly at the beginning of the semester and then reiterated throughout? I just want to hear more about what that process is, and especially how that has changed or how that might be different during the pandemic and during remote teaching.
Yeah, those are both difficult questions. For me, it's mostly modeling from the beginning that I am human, that I make mistakes, that I say silly things, that I screw up deadlines, that a million little things might be wrong with Canvas. So part of it is just setting ground rules for it's okay to make mistakes, and it's okay to acknowledge mistakes, and it's okay to do reparative work when you make mistakes. And I have had older professors tell me early in my career, you know, to never let them see you sweat, that students will run you ragged and take advantage of you if you show them any vulnerability. And what I find is very much the opposite, that there's a difference between weakness and vulnerability. If I'm really, really off my game and wishy-washy, then yes, students are going to start to feel insecure. And earlier in my career, I've had, you know, I had situations where I just wasn't decisive enough about what I was doing, and students were less satisfied with my performance and with what they learned in the class. But, you know, the last 5-6 years of my career, I've gotten pretty comfortable with the kind of norms that I want to set. So first of all, it's putting really explicitly in my syllabus. And then, of course, one of the things that COVID has brought on is a lot of pre-recorded stuff. So now I will pre-record the first day of school. And so I can talk through what's really important to me about trauma-informed pedagogy and what it means and what critical theory means and what intersectionality means and how those things influence my teaching and also what I'm willing to give on and what I'm not willing to give on. So I think by whatever fluke, I have a somewhat intimidating personality. And so people don't see me as an easy mark and then are generally relieved to know that I'm pretty flexible and easygoing once they understand the basic parameters. So a lot of it is just setting up the rules in advance through Canvas, through videos, through the syllabus, and then just reinforcing that's how things are going to go. So like my first semester at UT, I was incredibly surprised that multiple students asked me to inflate their grades for no reason. But after that, I just said, don't ask me to inflate your grade. Like first day of class, don't do it. You are desperate for that 0.1 increase and you have work you can make up, negotiate with me and I might let you make up that work. But absolutely do not come to me and ask me to inflate your grade just because. And no one has done it since. So I think, you know, it's hard to say like what makes things work and what doesn't, then it's sort of just softening from there on out. You know, it's sort of like being like, yes, we have to meet our deadlines. This is very important. I need you to learn this. But of course, if you're having a hard time, come talk to me. If you have accommodations, let's talk about your accommodation.
All of that made a lot of sense. And I mean, I also really like that you point out students' response to trauma-informed practices, because I think that people like to think that these kinds of pedagogies will make it so that teachers get taken advantage of. And mm-hmm. I've just never had that experience with trauma-informed pedagogy. Anyway, I'm really interested to hear you talk about the community that you create with your students. You were talking about how you found that your students emulate you in a lot of ways or perpetuate the environment that you've set up. Can you talk about how students did before COVID form that community and what that looks like? And if you've seen that shift at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think we do a lot of reflective work and I teach developmental psychology and I teach sociology of the family. I teach these things that are immediately applicable to your own life, right? And I teach them with the underpinning of 99% of these theories were written by old white men for kind of old white men. And so we are all allowed to be critical in how we assess and apply these theories. And I usually just lead by example where, you know, if I'm talking about family systems theory, I may talk about my family of origin and some of the dysfunctional aspects that are easily understood through the lens of family systems theory. And then, you know, if I say, here's an activity, let's get into groups and let's analyze this case study or let's talk about this phenomenon, I can say, you can talk about a personal example if you want to, you are not required to, or you can talk about an example like in the media, you know, in comic books or pop culture. So I try and model a certain amount of vulnerability, and it's a hard line to follow, right? It's hard to, it's very intuitive to figure out what's too much information and what's too withdrawn from students. And I definitely like err on the side of being more vulnerable, but, you know, not to the extent that I would be uncomfortable with the stuff that I've talked about in classes. So I find students who've taken my classes understand that my method of teaching, my goal is synthesis, right? This is in my teaching statement. It is not being able to memorize all of the theorists and the periods in which they did their stuff and what their theories were named. I do not care at the end of my developmental psych class if they remember those things. What I do care is if a few of the theories, they've really digested them, they've applied them to their own lives, they've applied them to other theories to see how they stack up, and they know a few of them well enough that they can take them into the next course and be able to apply them and integrate them with new learning with ease. And so synthesis, as I understand it, especially through the lens of transformative learning, is this process of sort of tasting and chewing and digesting and sorting information. And you do that through applying it to your own lived experiences, or as we also often do in class, to current events. So those are kind of the two mechanisms for synthesis that I use. We also do case studies and research papers and all sorts of other stuff. But I think that process of synthesis is something that students have to get used to. And I usually do it through a combination of things like, you know, small discussions in class. So I'll do a short lecture, show a video, speak for a few minutes, have them get into small groups, talk about it, report back out. And we do essentially the same thing in the online world. We just use the breakout groups in Zoom. In that way, I know that if I've got a student in this class who's been in another one of my classes, they already know the process through which we do this. They already, you know, can sort of go, oh, I can apply it to this thing that happened to me this summer or this thing that's going on in the world right now. We have COVID as the like eternal example of everything from, you know, cognitive distortion to epidemiology to political science. Like, we can use it for all these things now. So anyway, my veteran students kind of already understand that. And the other thing I do that sort of gets the ball rolling is I do a current events section at the beginning of all of my classes, although it's more in-depth and more detailed in my ethics class and my sociology-focused class. Last semester, before the lockdown, I had Asian American students who were being harassed for showing some resemblance to people who were Chinese that the president was blaming for COVID. And they were experiencing that on a direct level. And so, you know, we were able to talk about that in class and discuss resources on campus and ways to be an ally. This combination of sort of applying theory and science to our lived experiences and sort of testing it in that way and also applying it out into the real world and testing it that way helps create a creative, critical thinking environment.
I will also just say that I really love the way that you are talking about what you teach your students and how they take it out into the world. The classroom isn't contained. That right. You know, I know you weren't necessarily using the word in that way, but it isn't really a container. The idea is for them to go out and actually be able to make use of all of
right.
this knowledge.
Absolutely.
So I really like how you're describing that.
I did want to say, when talking about building community during COVID, and so this summer and then fall semester, so the emergency spring, half the spring semester, I started talking to students about the possibility that we were going to be moving online several weeks before it happened. And I just said to them, hey, this is what's going to happen if we move online. This is how I'm going to do it. It'll be fine. We'll keep the same basic format. It'll all make sense. So when we left on like March the 13th or whatever day it was, I feel like my students had some sense that my classes would go okay. And then I started a community page on a network called Mighty Networks, that it's kind of like a Facebook group without data mining and advertising. And so I invited all of my current former students and TAs to join it. And it's kind of, it's not crazy active, you know, the way like a lot of Facebook groups are now during COVID, but I'll post things on it that are funny, that are social justice related, that are community related, and students will sometimes comment and post stuff themselves. And so I think I have a couple hundred members now, and it's kind of a way of staying in touch. And if we get off on a tangent during class, I can say, I will go put this onto the student community page so you can read it, because I don't need to take, I can't take up more class time, or it's not totally apropos of what this class covers. And so it's been a really good way of sort of holding the container beyond the classroom and staying in touch a little bit beyond the classroom. And there's a lot of humor to it. And as you guys know, as a social media scholar, I'm really interested in how humor is used on the internet as an adaptive function for managing trauma. And so it's been a really fun kind of experiment and place to just sort of like stay in touch with current and former students. And so that's helped a lot during the COVID times, particularly.
So I'm really interested in the kind of confluence or integration of different, like what would normally be conceived as different pedagogies or different approaches to subject matter, that is between like critical theory, a transformative pedagogy and trauma-informed pedagogy. And just kind of anecdotally, that feels right. Like it feels right to me that if you are involved in one of those approaches, that somewhere along the way, the other two will also come into your purview. So would it be right in thinking that, you know, it would be very difficult to disentangle, you know, a critical approach from a trauma-informed approach or transformative from a trauma-informed approach? And which feels kind of prior to you, or it felt prior to you when you were sort of starting teaching?
I think I was unwittingly trained in transformative pedagogy or transformative learning because I was an adult learner for 3 of my 5 degrees. And it's a common enough approach in adult learning, and also in a liberal arts environment like St. Edward's or like my graduate school, Fielding Graduate University. So I think that sort of came first in my ideas about synthesis and learning and applying things to your life. And also sitting, one of the main concepts in trauma-informed pedagogy is the disorienting dilemma, in transformative learning. Disorienting dilemma, and it generally tends to be identified with adult learners, but I dispute that. And it's when a learner comes up against concept or a theory or an idea that calls into question their perception of themselves or reality. And they can have stress around that. They can have trauma around that. And they have to sort of sit through that and work through it in order to integrate this new way of looking at the world. So, for example, I had a student at St. Edward's who was employed by a well-known tech company in town that's sort of known for its warm, fuzzy image. And she saw herself as a very human-oriented manager, but when we were learning about mechanistic learning theories, which were much more based on a machine metaphor, of sort of slotting people into places and having them be everyone sort of having their own function and being able to sort of replace people as needed, she realized that her approach was much more mechanistic, and it made her uncomfortable for a while to see that, because some of the mechanistic approach to management is very dehumanizing. And that isn't to say that all mechanistically based organizations are dehumanizing, right? We can do jobs that are mechanistic and still be in a comfortable or in a healthy environment. But she had to sort of integrate that to get through it. And so that's one of the reasons, you know, why I have this idea of a psychological container, because it really comes from that theory that you have to create a space where it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's okay to feel stressed out around the things that you're learning, because they're making you look at the world in different ways. And I've experienced that so many times in my own learning, but I've learned to accept it and to some extent rejoice in it, because it means I will come out the other end with a slightly broader, more enlightened view than I started with. And so I think that was the original thing. But in my graduate program, I got much more involved in critical pedagogy and social justice in general, and the beginnings of really unpacking my privilege, which was something I hadn't really done. And so that was when ideas of intersectionality and privilege and oppression and social injustice became much more primary to how I felt it was ethical to teach in the classroom. And so when I encountered trauma-informed pedagogy, I had moved from St. Edward's, where my students were mostly white and Hispanic and sort of age 30 to 50, to UT, where my students are about 95% women, and I would say 75% non-white, so some version of women of color. And it became more and more imperative to me to understand what racial trauma is like and discrimination is like, and also be incredibly transparent about the fact that I can't, just because I can't directly relate to it as a privileged white woman, doesn't mean it doesn't exist and I shouldn't make space for it and respect it in the classroom. From an ethical point of view, it became incredibly important to me to not decouple creating a healthy container for my students and constantly trying to be aware of how my privilege affects how I portray information. And so again, if a student calls me out and says, and this happened in one class, you just spent the entire class talking about married families and you never talked about single parents. What's up with that? I could say, well, you know, that's just not what we're covering today. But instead I was like, oh crap, you are totally right. You know, would you like to talk about that? I am sorry I didn't cover that. I will make sure I integrate that more into the next lecture. And so it's being receptive to other people's perspectives, you know, in perpetuity, because I'm never not going to be a privileged person, which means I'm never not going to make the mistakes associated with privilege when I'm talking to a population of students who have dealt with types of trauma specifically tied to racism that I will never experience myself.
I'm really fascinated by your background and, you know, speaking to the importance of intersectionality, the intersection of all of your backgrounds,
right,
from performance to where you are now in the department that you're teaching in. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is something that you can speak to, but I'm really curious, because trauma-informed pedagogy can be practiced in all kinds of different ways.
Right.
I'm curious to know if you have found that there are ways actually that CNS or that sciences and maybe departments that tend to be a little bit more resistant to these kinds of approaches. Do you think that there are things about trauma-informed pedagogy that actually lend themselves really well to those environments?
That's a good question. I mean, I think certainly any discussion of ethics in science can be trauma-informed because, and should be trauma-informed. Everyone has to go through some version of IRB ethics training if you're in our department. And that means you have to read about the Tuskegee experiments and other gross ethical violations that are tied to race and socioeconomic inequality. So I think that can be an opening for sure. But I've run up against this before, you know, where my colleagues are math teachers and they don't really know how to deal with if there's campus trauma. So I came to UT right after the stabbing that had happened. And I saw that generation of students sort of all the way through graduation. So every time something else traumatic happened on campus, if there was a theft or last semester, like cars were being set on fire, everyone would start talking about the where were you when the stabbing happened. It was this deep wound that kept getting reopened. I have a way of accessing that because I'll say, what current events are linked to child welfare or socioeconomic issues or ethics? And so we can kind of slide into these discussions of campus politics and campus safety and campus current events that I think is healing and helpful. It's a lot harder for a math professor to say, everyone, let's take some deep breaths and then talk about ourselves, right? But I do think one of the things that's interesting right now is that the Zoom environment reduces power distance. And I've actually talked about this with my therapist a lot. She's finding some richness in her relationship with her clients that she hadn't before, because she's in her home and I'm in my home. And we kind of get to see each other as people a little bit more. And I definitely work that to my advantage. When I'm teaching, I have a very, as you know, sort of extra office, and my daughter comes in and out, and I don't try and hide the fact that, you know, I'm a mom and I'm living through this chaos, and you know, we're all sort of in this together, and I get to see my students' pets. And so, like, I have heard discussion from math teachers, like in my non-tenure track faculty group, who have like bring your pets to school days, where the people bring their pets on camera or their pet rocks or their like... or their plants, you know, or wear a funny hat day or stuff like that. And so I do think that that environment helps reduce power distance, which will make students feel more comfortable talking to a teacher if they're having problems. And that's one of the main issues that's coming up in COVID is, as we've discussed, some students are facing extreme trauma. We're all facing some level of trauma and eventual PTSD from this period. But for some students, it's much, much more extreme. And they're going through really unthinkable, difficult times. And the culture in CNS is often just very suck it up. And so when students come to me, I'm like, please file this with the Dean of Students. I will give you the accommodations either way, but, you know, get a temporary disability waiver from the disability office so that you can get accommodations, have it filed with the Dean of Students so that you have this paperwork you can show to other teachers who may be less flexible. And I do think that if you allow yourself to be more human on camera and less, you're not surrounded by the trappings of being at UT. And I think that that can help reduce some of the anxiety students have around connecting with their teachers. I've certainly used it to my advantage. At the same time, I feel like I have a lot of students this semester, and I worry about the ones who haven't reached out to me. I worry about the ones who don't feel comfortable talking to me because they probably don't feel comfortable talking to other professors either. And that concerns me. I'm worried about the people who are slipping through the cracks that I'm not catching. But yeah, I do think for whatever reason, you know, this environment can be more personal and more jokey and funny. You know, a lot of teachers are using like Star Wars backgrounds on their Zoom and stuff like that. And also the other thing that happens is the chat in Zoom is like this beautiful thing where students will post memes and give me a hard time about my t-shirt and dote on my daughter and share voting information. The other day they spent 15 minutes sharing voting information. And I was like, yeah, I'm gonna go on with the lecture, but y'all just keep working that out in the chat. So that's been super cool. There's a lot of richness in there that you can't have in the classroom because it would be disruptive. You know, I think that teachers who are not used to this level of informality may struggle, but if they can kind of lean into that discomfort a little bit, it might really help create more of the trust that we need with students in order to, because trauma-informed pedagogy goes two ways, right? I can't practice it if students don't trust me and if they don't believe it when I say, I am not going to penalize you if you decide to do an alternate assignment. Getting them to believe that they have the flexibility and the agency to do such a thing can be difficult. So I'm finding some really fun, little interesting things about the online environment that kind of help facilitate that process in a way that being on campus didn't.
You know, that's something I've thought about a lot, that it feels like we are at a watershed moment around trauma-informed pedagogy, just because by necessity, we're all forced to really scrutinize how it is, you know, we make demands of ourselves and how it is we make demands of others in this environment. And, you know, for the first time that I can remember, we're getting a lot of top-down messaging from the university that is trauma-informed, that is indicating the importance of recognizing the widespread and uneven distribution of trauma yep. in our populations, which is great. And at the same time, that sudden sea change, along with everything that is going on and changing so rapidly, can produce kind of the adverse effect, which is people retreating into, you know, old habits and corrosive habits. And I can't think of any particular examples of that, but when I, you know, look at the memes that students are posting, it feels like they're experiencing those things in kind of equal measure. Like there's a lot of outpouring and support and care on online platforms. And there's a lot of concern about lack of tolerance and lack of acceptance around unexpected circumstances.
I think that some professors are retreating into rigidity because that is the most comfortable, because it is so uncomfortable to be in this place that is so ambiguous and weird and we don't know when it's going to end. I kind of embrace weirdness and change as opportunities to learn. And it doesn't mean that I don't get uncomfortable when uncomfortable things happen, but I'm also kind of a techno nerd. And so I'm like, ooh, I can learn this new thing and try this new thing. But, you know, to tie it back to how trauma-informed pedagogy is working in the K-12 environment where my daughter is right now, I'm seeing those same patterns. I'm seeing teachers who are sort of doing similar things to what I'm doing, which is taking time out to connect with students and to create communication and camaraderie, you know, letting kids talk about their video games and their dogs. And then other teachers who are retreating into more rigid, more goal-driven types of environments, which I don't feel works well with 22-year-olds, and I'm real sure isn't working real well with 10-year-olds. That inability for adults to recognize when they are having trauma and how it is affecting their behavior towards other people is really at the root of the issues that we always end up talking about with trauma-informed pedagogy. You cannot be aware of other people's trauma if you are not at least somewhat aware of your own. But some people, you know, retreat to cognitive distortion and I'm just going to sort of make everything exactly the same, as opposed to like, okay, we're all in this weird bowl of awful together. Let's figure out how to make it work. And I'm hoping, you know, that through this podcast and other ways that we're sort of connecting these dots that we've been talking about, that we can create norms amongst teachers for exploring self-care and exploring psychotherapy or wellness or mindfulness practices. We can't meet students where they are if we're not willing to do the work ourselves.
I mean, I love your discussion of self-awareness, and I really love your description of discomfort as really just a learning opportunity. I am wondering, again, with your background in opera, which is so cool, I have heard you talk before about having to watch back your performances and feeling a little cringy and uncomfortable with that. And I'm wondering if you have any advice for instructors who are still at the really early stages of getting comfortable with discomfort.
I don't say everyone should get therapy, because therapy is a really personal thing that's been super helpful in my life. And there are a lot of ways to unpack your stuff. But I do recommend a book, When Things Fall Apart. It's just really unflinching look at the human condition. And it really helps you, especially when we're in times like this where we just can't escape it. So we might as well try and find a way to breathe through it. Yes, privilege and trauma is incredibly unequally distributed across our society, but the human condition is pretty much the same when it comes to really the big existential scary things. And we all go through periods when things fall apart, and we have really similar experiences with it. And so her approach to sort of unflinching compassion can be really helpful during times of trauma and kind of open the door for whatever practice may help you deal with your difficult feelings the most. And it really encourages compassion towards others. So like one of the practices in Shambhala Buddhism for meditation isn't just mindfulness meditation. It's a type of compassion meditation. When you're feeling something that's uncomfortable or painful, you breathe it in for everyone in the world who's feeling it. And then you breathe out the antithesis to it. So if I'm feeling really like hot and tired and chaos-y in my head, and if I'm practicing this, I breathe that in for everyone in the world who's feeling this, so I don't feel as alone. And then I think, what would feel good? Well, being on a beach with a cool breeze would feel good. And I sort of breathe out that feeling. And it's just one practice, and there are myriad meditational practices, and meditation is hard. But just the constant reminder that we are all on this like spinning ball of earth together, and that there is always someone somewhere feeling the same things you're feeling, is a really good opening into unwinding your own trauma and feeling compassion towards other people.
Whenever you talk about your teaching, I admire how it feels like a comprehensive, integrated approach, which if someone else had that same kind of position, it might also feel kind of a little bit intimidating, or like, oh, I have to do years and years of work to get to this point.
No.
But I also feel like you have a really approachable way of inviting people to like participate in these same practices and ways of thinking, so that it doesn't feel like something that's a million miles away. And I just really appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm glad. I mean, I think if there's one thing I have learned from all of the degrees and traumas and everything that I've done, it's that humility is it, you know, not guilt or self-hatred, it's just humility, just knowing that like falling on your face is something everybody does. And the more you can accept it as part of a learning process, the better.
We want to thank Michael Ann, of course, for participating in this podcast. Thank you to you all for listening. And as always, we would like to thank the Faculty Innovation Center, who helped with this project by providing grant money, and Lates for their amazing editing skills.